powered by Tink Media.
Hi, welcome to Feed the Queue, your ultimate podcast discovery podcast. I'm Lauren Pacell. I founded Tink Media, and in this episode of Feed the Queue, I'm bringing you an episode of one of my favorite podcasts of 2024, Because the Boss Belongs to Us. It's a podcast that sets out to prove that Bruce Springsteen should be named a queer icon.
We like to listen sometimes to podcasts, sometimes to music, and sometimes to audiobooks. Stay tuned if you like recommendations. We're gonna bring them to your ears. We'll share with you some things we've been loving, and we'll try to feed your queue.
Now, you all know me, and if you listen to my episode of Feed the Queue, where I talk about tiny dinos, you know about how I fell in love with audio. So I thought I'd use this opportunity to talk about a few podcasts that were made in 2024 that I don't think got quite enough love. One of them is In the Dark. It's season 3 of In the Dark, now produced by The New Yorker. This season was about the 2005 Haditha massacre, during which 24 unarmed Iraqi civilians were killed by U.S. Marines. It is one of the greatest long-form investigative projects I've ever listened to. They got access to some classified documents and photos that completely reconstruct the story, and they captured some jaw-dropping audio. For Cement City, journalist Jean Marie Laskus moved into a tiny town in Pennsylvania called Denora to learn what it's like to live there. And she captured more than 850 hours of tape for this podcast called Cement City. And the whole show is building up towards Denora's general election and a Christmas celebration. But along the way, she really like figures out what it's like to live there. And it feels like we're living there too. So Cement City. And finally, this one is fresh in my mind, and I found it on Reddit, so I don't think enough people are talking about it. It's called The Telepathy Tapes, and it's one of the most mind-twisty things I've listened to in a while. At its heart is this theory that nonverbal people with autism are telepathic and have otherworldly perceptions. It's both an unbelievable thing to think about, but when you think about it a lot, it makes a lot of sense. One of the many things you hear people say on the show is, this is going to sound crazy, but... So it's some of the craziest things I think I've heard that actually make a lot of sense. The storytelling is good. There's amazing tape, The Telepathy Tapes. If you want to find more shows that really aren't getting highlighted anywhere else, Tink just released their annual Audio Delicacies, which is a list of the best podcasts of the year, according to people who really love audio. The Tink team reaches out to audio makers and audio obsessives and get their favorite pick. And there's a lot of shows in there that aren't making other lists. I, for one, found so many treats that I wouldn't have found anywhere else. So go to tinkmedia.co. There's a plug for Audio Delicacies at the top, or you can just go to tinkmedia.co/audio-delicacies-2024. One of the many reasons I love Because the Boss Belongs to Us is I love a podcast with a mission. And Because the Boss Belongs to Us has a very specific mission to prove that Bruce Springsteen is a queer icon. Jesse Lawson and Holly Cassio are going through very specific arguments, and they're kind of like lectures on whether or not Bruce is camp, an underdog, whether Bruce is relatable, whether or not you can cry, dance, and fuck to Bruce's music, and whether or not the queer community is even buying this argument that he's a queer icon in the first place. That's all before the final verdict, which I'm not going to spoil it for you. That's in the last episode. You should listen to the whole thing. But in this first episode that you're about to hear, it's really, really, really important because it sets out the mission of the show. You get to know Jesse and Holly and why they're here, how they connected. And I also should just note that Holly is a zine artist, and the whole podcast just feels very like homemade it's made with love. It's made with friendship. And I kind of feel like I'm sitting on the floor with Jesse and Holly at like a slumber party or something listening to it. So I love how it sounds. I love everything about it. And it was my number one pick of 2024. So enjoy.
Hi, cuties. Andrea here. And if you're obsessed with creating amazing podcasts as much as you are with discovering them, then you need to check out The Podcast Live. Host Deanna brings you insider tips and lessons learned from over a decade in the industry. And you'll hear from top pros at Wondery, Rolling Stone, The Daily Beast, and This American Life, just to name a few. It's all about helping you make your podcast the best it can be. Add The Podcast Live to your queue today and start leveling up your podcast game.
Well, now I'm putting my trousers on. I found a red cap, which I've put in the back pocket of my blue jeans, like in the one in the USA album cover. And I looked it up and it is receiving fisting, is what I'm flagging. Oh, I need to put my willy in, which is some socks and stuff, and now my pants.
I'm Jessie. I'm a 31-year-old audio producer and youth worker from London. Last year, I started doing drag as Butch Springsteen.
Can you just describe where we are and what you're doing?
We're in the dressing room of the RVC, the Royal Vauxhall Tavern, which is London's oldest queer venue, I think.
It's one of the oldest anyway. This is a recording of me backstage, getting ready for one of my first ever performances at a night called Kings of Clubs, run by drag king Frankie Sinatra.
And then my tool belt goes on. The spanner goes in the tool belt, and then I tuck the tool belt into the jeans. Because I take my clothes off later as a fun reveal.
Where I grew up in London, the only people who'd heard of Bruce Springsteen were my friends' dads. Bruce is usually described as a rock or Americana musician, but each album's different. You've got hints of rock and roll, or 80s synth pop, emotional man with a guitar. It's always reminded me of country. Not the tunes necessarily, but the way Bruce tells stories. His songs have these big, grand narratives, tales of characters that Bruce has made up or based on people in his life. I discovered Bruce Springsteen when I was 20. I knew who he was before then, but that's the first time I properly heard his music. It went straight into my insides, pulling out feelings that I didn't even realise I had yet, giving them new words as they were held up to the light.
I want to be more masculine so I look like Bruce. So I'm putting like a big white line down my nose to try and make my nose look as wide as possible. And I'm gonna try and make my like jaw look as square as possible. Like the opposite of what drag queens do is what drag kings do, basically. I feel like sometimes people go through phases when they're like teenagers of being really good at putting makeup on. And I always felt like I was trying to do drag when I put makeup on because I was just so bad at it. And sometimes I've come to school with like, you know, like mascara all down your face and stuff like that.
Bruce Springsteen has had many looks over the years. The one I'm currently getting into is inspired by his 80s era. Blue denim, butt-hugging tight jeans, white t-shirt with a denim vest over the top. In the 80s, he had this mop of curly dark brown hair, often pushed back with a little bandana. Later on, I'll strip down to a denim harness I made myself. That's more Butch Springsteen than Bruce Springsteen, but a boy can dream.
I'm really sweaty as well, so it feels like it's all going to run off my face.
Each act I do is based on a different Bruce song. In the one I'm about to do, I go on stage with a huge cardboard red car, explain that she's my girlfriend, and she's upset with me. It turns out she's annoyed with me because I don't go down on her properly, so I learn how to do it on stage while singing Bruce's I'm Going Down. It's fun and silly and campy. I've always loved watching drag, but I never thought I'd be able to get up on stage in front of a crowded room doing it myself.
Please, welcome to the stage, Butch Springsteen!
Hi. I'm Butch Springsteen. I'm an internationally famous musician from New Jersey. but I can only do a South American accent, so we're just going to deal with it.
This is Because the Bus Belongs to Us. It's a series that has truly been years in the making, where my love for Bruce Springsteen takes me to places I never would have expected. Who wore it best, Bruce Springsteen or Katie Lang?
It's like you squint and everyone can be a Butch.
Why do sad dykes love Nebraska?
On my dating profile, I had something about being a fan of Nebraska-era Bruce Springsteen.
Is Bruce, in fact, the ultimate emo?
It was with Bruce's music that when I first arrived, I thought I'd assimilate into straight culture, which is such a joke now, considering.
Let's start at the beginning.
Okay, so I'm sitting in my bedroom. I'm about to start making another issue of Cauchemal, which is like my little diary zine.
This is Holly Cassio. They make a zine series called Me and Bruce, all about how a northern working-class DIY punk fell in love with Bruce Springsteen. They also made a graphic memoir called Looking for Bruce, charting their spiritual pilgrimage to New Jersey to somehow find the real Bruce Springsteen. Holly is the key to this whole thing.
I thought this would be a really nice time to message you, reflecting on my teenage queer love of Bruce Springsteen, because this is exactly how it started. Me sitting on the floor surrounded by loads of papers and a long arm stapler, and I've no idea where on earth my Pritt stick is. So that's why I'm taking a moment to message you instead of looking for my Pritt stick. Hello! I'm currently sitting in my room. I have a picture on my wall of one of Bruce and Clarence's famous kisses. I've like backed it onto some pink tissue paper and then put it in a white frame, and it sits on my wall.
Back in 2020, I was introduced to Holly by a friend of mine. He was like, you're queer, you like Bruce Springsteen, you would like Holly Cassio. It was in the midst of a COVID-19 lockdown, so our first communication was through emails and voice notes.
My memory is being like 13, 14, and being queer, but not out. It's the 90s, so the internet exists, but it doesn't exist in like everyone's houses, and it definitely doesn't exist in our house. Section 28 exists, so no one talks about being queer or feeling different at school. Like, Section 28 just means that no one talks about that kind of thing.
For anyone who hasn't heard of Section 28, it was a UK law passed under Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher in 1988, which prohibited the, quote, promotion of homosexuality by local authorities. This led to loads of teachers and students feeling unable to come out in school, let alone provide or access healthy LGBT sex education. The law only started being repealed in England in 2003, so when I was 11. But for Holly, all of their schooling was under Section 28. Not a great time to be a queer teenager in the UK.
I was really badly bullied. I didn't have any friends. And so for me, zines were a lifeline. They were like this physical, tangible dispatch from out there, somewhere, from a bunch of queers saying, yeah, there's more of us out here, you're not alone, like, there's stuff happening, you can be part of this.
I was quite a repressed teenager, I would say, in terms of my sexuality and gender. I remember I came out to my friends as bisexual when I was 12 at a sleepover. Everyone was saying, what percentage gay are you? And everyone was like, oh, maybe I'm like 1% gay. And then I was like, I think I'm 50% gay. And everyone was like, no, you're not. That's disgusting. And then I simply didn't talk about it or think about it again until I was in my 20s.
You know how sports fans meet each other and they have like three standard questions to like get the chat going? Like, what team do you support? Oh, so how do you feel about blah blah's performance this season? And then some kind of joke that shows that they know things about the sport they're talking about. Well, me and Holly did the queer Bruce fan version of that. We swapped our queer Bruce origin stories.
I had two Bruce records. I had Darkness in the Edge of Town, emo classic, and I also had Born in the USA, also an emo classic, but like wrapped up in the pretense of like a pop album. I was making a zine and I was making a mixtape for a friend, and I remember putting on Dancing in the Dark onto a mixtape as like a novelty song. I was like, lol, won't this be funny? Putting on this old dad music onto a mixtape. So I've got Dancing in the Dark on in the background. I'm sitting on the floor and I'm making this zine. And it's like I'm hearing the song for the first time. Like some of those lyrics just somehow hit me in the gut in a way that hasn't happened before. And I'm recognising it as the queer anthem of loneliness that it is. You know, there's like lines like, want to change my clothes, my hair, my face. Like, tell me Bruce isn't queer when he writes that line. Tell me Bruce isn't staring into reflection of himself, thinking about gender, thinking about how no one else he knows looks like him and how he feels really alone and isolated. But the lyric that for me always stood out, the lyric that like made me just stop dead in my tracks, is there's a line in that song that says, there's something happening somewhere, baby, I just know that there is. There is no encapsulation of my lonely, lonely small town queer teenage life than that line. It's really lonely. I think the queer teenage experience, particularly in the 90s, particularly during Section 28, particularly in a small town in West Yorkshire, sadly, it was a very lonely experience. And I remember hearing that line playing in the song when I was making a zine and just thinking, oh, that's it. That's exactly how I feel, that there's stuff happening out there. I'm just not part of it yet. It's kind of enough to keep me going. And I think that's where my lifelong obsession with Bruce Springsteen kind of started.
My lifelong obsession with Bruce Springsteen started a bit later than Holly's. I spent almost the entirety of my teenage years not allowing myself to think about my queerness. When I was 20, I moved to Canada for a year, and in very classic baby queer fashion, I shaved my head for the first time, unlocking lots of new feelings that I'd been hiding away under my curls.
And then I went to visit my friend in Chicago, Jake, who's this huge Bruce Springsteen fan. I remember we were cooking spaghetti carbonara and we were frying those like little weird lardons that you can buy in America, and like frying it so all the fat fell off and made them really crispy. And we were doing that and listening to Bruce in his kitchen, and he was telling me all of like the things that he loved about Bruce Springsteen. And the song, like the song that really got me was, it's still one of my favourite songs, it's called Ain't Good Enough For You.
Ain't Good Enough For You is quite an upbeat, cheeky song from an album called The Promise, a compilation album from 2010 of previously unreleased songs recorded in the late 70s. The character in the song is singing about his girlfriend, who can never be pleased. The chorus goes, no matter what I do, ain't good enough for you. There's a bit in it where he lists how he tried all the things people say you should do to please a partner. He gets a job in sales, he buys a fancy shirt, he gets the coolest record, buys a book about love and goes to her door with a bunch of flowers. And still, she says, he's not good enough. The feeling I related to in the song was him doing all the, quote, right things that society tells you to do, but it's still not working. Which is basically exactly how I was starting to feel about my gender. I tried on so many different ways society told me I could be a woman. From very butch to very femme, from the loosest, most shapeless, don't notice me clothes to bright pink hair and trainers. And listening to Bruce, I was like, yeah, I get how it feels to try all the different things and it still somehow just not be right.
But I guess I didn't realise at that point that you could just be trans. And so now, obviously, that makes a lot more sense. So many of his songs are about having a lot of feelings, being misunderstood, being in a place where there aren't people like you or people don't understand you, and then needing or wanting escape. And that was definitely the kind of angst I was feeling at that time. And I've never really looked back.
The end of those voice notes, sharing our Bruce Springsteen backstories, was an invitation.
Yeah, for me to make a podcast with you about queerness and Bruce Springsteen.
Hello, Holly.
Hello, Jesse.
Yeah, so you said yes. And now you're my co-host.
Correct.
So something that came out of those first chats was how many queer Bruce fans you know. I think you're maybe like the third queer Bruce fan I ever met. But it turns out there's loads of us.
Yeah, I also spent so many years thinking I'm the only queer person to find meaning in the songs of this kind of centrist dad. But once I started making my Bruce scenes, loads of people started reaching out, and you were by no means the first person to contact me being like, I love Bruce too. There's actually loads of us out there.
The more I found out there were loads of queers who love Bruce Springsteen, the more questions I had. What is it about Bruce? Why are we so obsessed with him? And why don't people know that Bruce is loved by queer people?
Me too, 100%. These questions are a huge part of my life. And that's why we're putting our serious journalist hats on to get to the bottom of Bruce's queer appeal.
That's next. Jessie.
Holly.
Because the bus belongs to us.
We know from personal experience that other queer Bruce lovers do exist, but I also know that a lot of queer people react to my love of Bruce Springsteen with confusion and surprise.
Yeah, me too. He is simply a rich, white, straight, cis man who is heavily associated with the American flag, one of the least queer symbols known to man.
Either that, or the St. George flag or English flag, which I basically only see at fascist rallies or painted onto the faces of drunk, scary men at the football.
Yeah, that kind of nationalist pride is just not giving queer. Bruce Springsteen is not someone you'd think of if someone asked you to list celebrities loved by the queer community.
Madonna, Celine Dion, Whitney Houston, Mariah Carey. I really, really, when I was young, particularly looked to largely cis female straight women to sort of narrate the big emotions I was feeling, which was like deep loss, heartbreak, loneliness.
Even if Bruce feels niche or unconventional as an object of queer fandom, queer people have a long history of stanning celebrities.
Hello, my name is Tom Rasmussen.
And my friend Tom is one of them. They're a pop star, composer, writer, sex columnist, former drag queen.
And proud dog mom to Celine Dion, who you can hear snoring on my lap right now.
Celine lay sleeping on Tom's lap for the entire interview.
Celine. She's such a joy, honestly.
Having a dog called Celine feels to me like it gives Tom the right credentials to talk about the queer community's relationship to celebrity.
And they are actually in the industry. So I wanted to talk to them to see where or if Bruce could fit into this list of celebrities loved by the queer community.
The good ones, you know, Shirley Bassey, Tina, Derek Onick, a bit of Britney, Christina, basically anyone who could actually sing. When I got to thinking about why I was so drawn to them is because they were people who looked like women, but who were given permission or demanded permission to step outside of their gender category, right? Mm. And so, like, you know what I mean? Shit like that is just so inspiring to be like, oh, there's another way of life.
Tom became obsessed with these celebrities.
I think I initially misinterpreted that as wanting to be famous, but I think I'm just trans, basically.
It was just like such a classic day.
The classic. It's like stepping outside of the expected and being celebrated for that, I think, is a really key thing.
Yeah, so these female pop stars were acting in ways that weren't available to the women in Tom's life. I really resonate with that feeling of finding hope. Basically, that you can also step outside of the expectations placed on you based on your gender.
I think it's also having big emotions that aren't policed. They like get to talk about what's happening inside them. I think all of that stuff I wasn't really allowed to do, and young queer people are not allowed to do, because if you do, there's fear you'll betray your queerness, and then what happens? Mm. Oh, that's now Celine burping. Celine Dion burps on radio.
When Tom's talking about these celebrities that they love, they refer to them as gay icons or queer icons.
It feels like there's a difference between just like musicians that queer people like and those big personalities that rise to iconhood. What is it that draws queer people to certain celebrities? What do we see in them that makes us feel seen?
Yeah, me and Tom asked ourselves that as well.
We were talking about the kind of celebrated over-the-topness that seems to link these icons together, which to us feels quite camp.
The camp is always a step ahead of you. And I think a real icon is. A real icon knows what is in control. A real icon.
And it's self-aware.
It's self-aware. It's in control. But it's also not as well. Like, but it knows more than it lets on. So much more than it lets on.
Mm.
Camp is, like, surprising.
Mm.
And an icon remains surprising, I think.
Mm, keeps you on your toes.
Keeps you on your toes, keeps you interested, or else they just fall off, you know? Mm.
Oh, yes, this makes so much sense. There is something so camp about a lot of these straight women who are chosen by queers. Just look at Jennifer Coolidge.
Seeing celebrities being outrageous and being celebrated for it is very compelling to me. It is interesting that so far as we know, they're all cis straight women.
I know. Are straight men so oppressed that they don't even get a look in at being considered a queer icon?
Well, interesting that you'd say that. Because another thing that we talked about was it's even more compelling if their journey to fame included some hardship.
Madonna is like the girl whose mother died and she's from a family of seven siblings? And she came to New York with $32 in her pocket. That is true, but also like, the struggle sort of stopped there.
Mm.
She sort of had a few club hits and then, you know, was just made into a massive star. And she made herself into a massive star. I think also that's key. Celine Dion, who I would say is one of the last living entertainers. She was like from this big family in Montreal, sort of plucked from obscurity. There's a sense of struggle.
Tom isn't saying that fame fixed every one of these women's problems and they never felt struggle again. But this narrative of coming from nothing and then being discovered or rising to fame in some way, it makes sense why queer people would be into that.
Oh yeah, the amount of time I spend thinking about how my heroes have also come from hardship and survived, made it out of there, reinvented themselves, it's like proof that one day you could do that too.
And I also think there's something vindicating about, like, even if the people around you don't recognise it yet, there's something special about you that the world will someday celebrate you for. Which I think is something you have to try and cling on to if you're a queer person who's shamed and bullied for your queerness.
And also really continues probably throughout their career to peddle that narrative of like, I had it hard, I came from nothing.
Right.
Cher is an amazing... I mean, and it's all true, Cher, Tina, all those people. It's true of them all, but it's also...
Not anymore.
And it's a narrative peddled.
Yeah.
That's why the most iconic of all my icons, the most iconic moment of any of them ever was when Madonna released Ray of Light, because it was the most aware of where she was now. And it was like honest. It was like, I'm famous and I've been doing this to look for a mother and I became a mother and that's what I needed all along. And I have been misunderstanding this whole journey. And that was like, whoa. Now that was like rug from under, because it was just really aware of what game she'd been playing, kind of thing.
This is so relevant to Bruce Springsteen. So many of his songs are about working class struggles. His dad worked in a factory, but he started being a musician at 16. And his joke these days is, I've never worked a day in my life.
His class experience is kind of genuine and the narrative peddled at the same time.
People think they can just put on a great outfit, dye their hair, every album cycle a different colour, and get some pop bangers written and they'll become an icon. But that is not the same as being someone who speaks truth. And if you think about what actually connects all the icons that I can think of, and Bruce probably, definitely actually, there's truth. And there's, of course, you dress that up, you Trojan horse it maybe by wild outfits and pulling publicity stunts, but really, that's why the campus moment, let's say, in Britney Spears' career was when she released Blackout after she had her 2007 like public, really, really like horrific nervous breakdown.
Which she was pushed to by the paparazzi and the toxic celebrity culture of the early 2000s.
Blackout, which she still cites as one of her best albums, her best album, I think, was her telling the truth of that situation.
Mm.
It's just amazing. It's amazing. It's amazing. So you gain this, yeah, truth, right?
Harley.
Jesse.
This leads me to a proposal.
Okay.
So we know that Bruce is loved by lots of queer people. But for some reason, he kind of flies under the radar in the queer community.
He's not the first person who comes to mind when you say name a queer icon.
He's not. But I just think that Bruce Springsteen is an unsung queer icon. I think there's enough of us who love him and relate to him in the ways that Tong was talking about. And so that's my proposal. Me and you on a mission to get Bruce Springsteen the queer icon seal of approval.
Oh my God, yes, okay. And how would we make this happen? Like, who gets to say who a queer icon is?
Well, I thought maybe us. Talking to Tom, we kind of realised halfway through that we were sort of accidentally making a checklist for what people need to qualify as a queer icon.
Okay, so like, they need to be camp. And they need to have some kind of narrative of struggle for us to root for them as an underdog.
Yes, exactly. I feel like that's two solid checklist points. I was also thinking about the fact that Bruce is a musician. How do you tell the difference between a musician queers like and a queer icon that happens to be a musician? What does their music have to do to qualify for icon status?
I don't necessarily think that the music has to be played in a club necessarily, or like narrate queer euphoria necessarily, but I think maybe it has to narrate a certain part of a queer person's emotional life, right? So Lana Del Rey, Lana Del Rey's music, right, allows you into like a very complicated relationship with men, to be the complicated person in a relationship with a man. So, you know, gay men or straight trans girls, basically. Or bisexuals, of course. All of this goes without saying that there are like everyone of every gender and of every race and of every sexuality stands these people in their own different ways,
right? Yeah.
I think it has to narrate or facilitate an emotion,
a feeling
that's quite deep, and so that is euphoria for sure, or like real sadness, or loneliness,
like,
or obsession,
deep sadness.
Yeah, a lot of my friends, because of certain, and people I know, because of certain things they've been through, are quite talented at dissociation. And this is across the sort of spectrum of sexualities and genders, sort of ignoring what's happening with them inside, because I guess a big thing we all have to do when we're young in a really homophobic society and transphobic society is to hide the true emotions going on, because that would betray our queerness, and that isn't always the safest option. And so we get quite good at dissociation, and I think a queer icon's music allows us into our emotions, feelings that might be hard to access or complicate to access. You know, can you dance to it? Can you cry to it? Can you fuck to it? Like, can you do something that is a bit more extreme and expressive, as opposed to like, can I just like bop along to it? But also, can you bop along to it? Oh my God, it's actually, you could do this forever.
Can you dance to it? Can you cry to it? Can you fuck to it? Well, that's the next item on our checklist then.
I think this is such an essential framing for a queer icon checklist. Can their music help drag you back from years of dissociation? What's queerer than that?
Okay, this is like proper science that we're doing. We have a hypothesis. Bruce Springsteen is an unsung queer icon. You and Tom have spoken about, like, the control category, if you will.
And they will.
We know that people who are already agreed upon as queer icons are camp. They have underdog status and have music that facilitates queer emotion. That's three great checklist points. I think we're ready to go.
There's one more thing I spoke to Tom about, which I think is important for us to think about. By the end of our chat, I'd realised this was the direction we needed to take the podcast in, a mission to make Bruce Springsteen a widely recognised queer icon. I told them, and they left me with this.
I think there is a sort of unanimously agreed upon code of people who are.
Yeah.
And also, I think one thing we've missed off this checklist is there's just something. It's really hard to name it.
Yeah.
But there is just something. You just know it.
Yeah.
As a queer person, you just know it in your solar plexus.
Little heart.
And yet, you know, you just know who's not and you know who is.
Yeah.
It's a feeling. So do they have it? Whatever it is. Maybe you'll find it over the next however many episodes. But I think that, yeah, you've got your work out, I think, because there has to be all these things. And I think Bruce is many, but who knows if he's all of them.
Is he all of them?
Challenge accepted. I, Holly Cassio, and you, Jesse Lawson, have anointed ourselves with queer scientist status on a mission to get Bruce Springsteen recognised as a queer icon.
Over the next 6 episodes, we will check if Bruce Springsteen is camp,
if Bruce Springsteen can be rooted for as an underdog,
if you can dance, cry and fuck to Bruce Springsteen's music,
and if other queer people would be willing to recognise Bruce as a queer icon too.
We know that Bruce has queer fans. Can we make him into a queer icon?
That's next episode. Because the Boss Belongs to Us is a production of Molten Heart and iHeart Podcasts.
We're hosted by Jesse Lawson and Holly Cassio.
The series is executive produced by Jesse and Holly and created by Jesse Lawson.
This episode was produced and sound designed by Jesse Lawson, with production assistance by Ali Adlington and Tess Hazel. Michelle Macklem is our mix engineer.
Our original music and theme is by Talk Bazaar at Talk BAZAAR _.
Our show art is designed and illustrated by Holly Cassio at Holly CASIO.
And for more Butch Springsteen content, they're at Butch Springsteen _drag.
Fact checking is by Selena Solin. Legal services provided by Rowan Moran and File.
Our executive producer from Molten Heart is Jasmine JT Green. Our executive producer from iHeart Podcasts is Lindy Hoffman.
Bye! Bye.
2 of Because the Boss Belongs to Us. You can find it wherever you find your podcasts. And for all things Tink Media and Feed the Q, find us at tinkmedia.co or follow us at social at Tink Media. Thank you and goodbye.
With us around, you'll never run out of things to listen to. With us around, you'll never run out of things to listen to, 'cause we'll feed your cue.